In his later years, Prokofiev took an ever so slightly mischievous delight in opus numbers. He would keep back a number with a special significance for an accordingly special work. His rousing wartime symphony, number 5, was opus 100, a solidly round number. Its successor, the savagely cathartic 6th, is opus 111, the same number as Beethoven's last and, for many, greatest piano sonata. And Prokofiev's last symphony, number 7, came into the world with a possibly even more momentous numerical pedigree, opus 131. That's the same as Beethoven's most revered late string quartet. Even the key is the same. It's a highly unusual C-sharp minor. So is Symphony No. 7 going to be a similar grand summation, probing the extremes, the heights and depths of Prokofiev's expressive world? Well, on the face of it, the answer would appear to be not at all. The Seventh Symphony was apparently written for broadcast on Soviet children's radio, and this is a master of composing for children. Remember Peter and the Wolf from 1936. And there are places in the Seventh Symphony where you could be listening to a maybe slightly spookier 20th century Nutcracker suite. There are also times when Prokofiev's Seventh Symphony suggests good, clean, simple childhood fun, like this upbeat mock march. And then there's the big tune, which we hear twice in the first movement and again at the climax of the finale. It's one of those glorious long Prokofiev melodies in his best fairy tale vein. There's possible comparison here with the ballet Cinderella of 1944. It feels very close in moments like this. There's certainly a feeling of swelling, glorious childhood dreams. For a long time after its appearance in 1952, the year before Prokofiev's death, the Seventh Symphony was either patronised or ignored. The old Penguin Guide to the Symphony notes that, after the 6th, the 7th is a very lightweight affair, full of charm but much less concentrated in feeling and content. Well, I'm not going to censure the writer, or indeed name him, since he had the grace to admit that he got it very wrong later. But nevertheless, that opinion was widely shared. Until recently. Well, I can't really take exception with the phrase full of charm. That's clear enough from the tasters we've already heard. But very lightweight? Certainly, the Seventh Symphony is restrained. It's nowhere near as volcanic or desolate as the 6th. But is it all blown thistledown? I don't think that's quite the scene that Prokofiev sets at the beginning. There's something indefinably Russian about that music. Is it the spaciousness, the long-breathed melody, the undeniably melancholic tone in those singing lines? And then there's that bell sound for piano, harp and low brass that starts and punctuates that music. Bell sounds are a kind of archetype in Russian music. They're often full of deep, if mysterious, dark significance. And certainly that C-sharp there does seem to be tolling in the midst of that music. Generally speaking, when it comes to melody, the Seventh Symphony is particularly rich. It contains some of Prokofiev's best, and indeed least self-conscious, melodic writing. Prokofiev, the ironist, the gleeful dispenser of acid sarcasm, shows his face surprisingly rarely in this symphony. Could that be to a certain extent a consequence of recent events? In 1948, just 4 years before he wrote the Seventh Symphony, Prokofiev had endured the notorious Party Central Committee resolution on arts and music. This represented another official clampdown on artistic production, an attempt to drive out the deviant, the challenging, anything that could in any way be felt to be subversive of the new Soviet utopia. Prokofiev was condemned viciously alongside fellow composers like Shostakovich. Then, in 1949, Prokofiev had an accident from which he suffered enduring concussion. In fact, he never fully recovered, and he could only compose if he tightly regulated his working life so as not to get too tired. So many restrictions from without and from within. And then, also recently, his first wife, Lena, the mother of his two children, who he'd left somewhat guiltily for another woman, was arrested on cynically concocted charges and sent to a labour camp. So, the tone of the Seventh Symphony, its apparent safeness, could possibly have been influenced by a need on Prokofiev's part to police himself, to anticipate what those party censors might have said, and also not to agitate himself too much, to look after his health. So maybe that partly explains the loss of the malicious glee, a consequence maybe of shock and sadness. Yet the more I get to know this symphony, the more I'm struck by its subtlety and the complexities beneath its seemingly simple surface. This children's symphony also has a very adult message. After the first flowering of the big tune in the first movement, that one which I suggested conveyed soaring childhood dreams, there comes a delicate but unsettling reversal. It's brought about by that spooky nutcracker music we heard at the start of the programme. These strange, slightly disconcerting reversals are very much a feature of the Seventh Symphony. Something similar happens at the end of the first movement. We seem to be settling from the original C-sharp minor to a warmer C-sharp major. Ah, you might feel like saying, but then comes the tiny touch of frost, a chilly minor chord on woodwind and piano. Thank you. After this comes a fast, waltz-like second movement, a scherzo in all but name. This too swings back and forward, and not always comfortably. At the beginning, Prokofiev definitely seems to be trying for childhood happiness. It's idyllic, a touch dreamy at first, and then it surges forward excitedly to take part in fun and games. Those little scraps of tune at the end on brass and pizzicato strings, they do sound like the kind of tunes you might hear chanted in a playground, don't they? But there are also hints of something less secure, more anxious later, often as with that frost minor chord at the end of the first movement. It's just a touch like the strangely dissonant viola stabs in the middle of this exquisitely pensive waltz melody. The second movement manages a rousing, glittering carnival conclusion. But the slow movement takes us back to dreams again. A lovely melody is passed round the orchestra, instrument to instrument. It's shared, as children might share happiness with friends or family. And as with Schumann's famous Träumerei, dreaming from his scenes from childhood, we also are aware subtly of the fact that it's an adult remembering the perfect happiness of childhood. It adds a touch of pathos, an ache for that land of lost content. It's so subtle, this gorgeous yet strangely bittersweet movement. And the return of the first theme brings touches of fabulous Prokofiev filigree scoring. Now surely this is a vision of something impossibly beautiful. Nothing can be as perfect as this in the real world. Perhaps there's a faint but telling reminder in music like that of lines from Dante's Inferno, lines apparently often invoked by Russians in the last years of Stalin's regime. There is no greater sorrow than to recall times of happiness in misery. Misery? Surely that's stretching it a bit. Yet the finale of Prokofiev's Seventh Symphony especially shows us how precarious the balance is in this symphony. It's something we've sensed throughout the work, but now it really stands forward. We begin with a merry circus atmosphere and a gallop tune. Gallop has an interesting pedigree in Soviet music. It was much used by Shostakovich, for instance, in some of his film scores and in his opera Lady Macbeth. And almost invariably, its triviality is contrasted with some dissonant, deadly serious element in the plot. Was Prokofiev thinking in similar terms? Well, now the hints of unease grow. Something threatening is making its way into the Elysian playing fields. A strangely anxious theme on strings provokes a return of the big tune. But now there's something anguished in the twists of harmony. The joy of the dreaming child yields much more quickly to the pain of the remembering adult. And now it all gets distinctly chilly, especially when baleful brass and strings add their voices. If you've been smiling indulgently at some of my comments about adult irony up till now, I think maybe that will convince you that I really do have a point. That's how Prokofiev's Symphony No. 7 ends, in some performances. The thing is, Prokofiev left two endings. According to Mstislav Rostropovich, the great cellist and an important friend to Prokofiev in his difficult last years, Prokofiev was persuaded that the symphony might have a better chance of success with those picky censors if he went for a more upbeat end. So Prokofiev lopped off that final, one might say, fateful pizzicato plunk and brought the gallop tune back on stage for a happy ending this time. So we have two very different endings to Prokofiev's Seventh Symphony. But even if you do opt for Prokofiev's second, jollier conclusion, there's still the memory of those baleful brass string chords and that strangely poignant fade of the big tune before it. In the end, I think it is more effective if you perform the Seventh Symphony as Prokofiev originally conceived it, before political expediency got in the way. For some years after Prokofiev's death, the revised version, with the happy ending, held sway. But in recent years, as people have stopped dismissing this symphony as lightweight and started looking at it more closely, opinion has gradually swung round in favour of that darker, or at the very least more equivocal, ending. And that's how we'll hear it performed tonight. It makes a more fitting end for a unique symphony. Like Schumann in Scenes from Childhood, Prokofiev manages to suggest both remembered innocence and sadder, wiser, pained experience at the same time. It's a distillation of a poignant ambiguity that often appears in Prokofiev's music, though rarely, I'd argue, more tellingly than here.